You're listening to the OMFIF podcast, the show that explores the latest insights and discussions on global finance, economics, and policy for people who love staying informed about the rapidly evolving landscape of the financial world. Join us as we break down complex topics, interview key thought leaders, and provide essential insights to keep you informed about the evolving world of finance.
Hello, and welcome to the OMFIF podcast. I'm Taylor Pierce, Senior Economist of OMFIF's Economic and Monetary Policy Institute. Here with me today is Dr. Elliot Hentov, Head of Macro Policy Research at State Street Global Advisors. We'll be discussing the interplay of geopolitics and financial markets and how investors are responding. Welcome, Elliot. It's a pleasure to have you.
Taylor, thank you for having me.
Great. So we can just jump right in. At the beginning of this year, it seemed like inflation was coming down, interest rates seemed to be on the path of normalization without severe contraction in economic activity. But recently, inflation seems to be on a bumpier path. Monetary policy expectations are a bit in flux, and there seem to be persistent geopolitical frictions. So perhaps earlier expectations were a bit too optimistic. What is your core macro outlook?
Our core macro outlook is actually quite sanguine. And I say that because I have a feeling as this podcast progresses, that sanguine tone may diminish a little bit when we talk about geopolitics. But our base case for the macro is that we've managed the soft landing of sorts. Basically, inflation has come down. We don't think it will go all the way. It will stay sticky at levels that are higher than what we've experienced for the past 15 years, but certainly at levels that are quite comfortable and manageable, both from a macroeconomic as well as from a financial market point of view. And that also means from an investment point of view, we are very much close to the consensus of liking the big locomotives of the market rally, particularly large cap US equities and technology stocks. And I emphasize this because as talk about the other issues, just because we like the base case doesn't mean we are blind to the risks and the alternate outcomes that could still come with us.
Right. So you say that there's a soft landing of sorts, but what could upset that view?
What could upset that is, well, basically, the soft landing means that at least peak monetary tightening is behind us. There's a lot of recalibration in terms of how much easing we may get, if at all. But what would upset it is anything that would reverse kind of the growth inflation mix. And we're less worried from a macro analysis point of view. We do not think there's a credible inflation revival in the US or elsewhere globally. We do not think that the labor market dynamics and others justify worries about inflation rising again or about growth dropping off a cliff as a result of different pressures. That's fine. What does worry us is what exogenous shocks could suddenly change the growth inflation makes, and that they would all come from the geopolitical or political arena.
Can you expand on some of the geopolitical risks?
There's basically three conceptually. The first one is a global energy supply shock. The second one is just a repricing of risk premia globally triggered by a reevaluation of some local or regional crisis. And the third would be risks associated with the US election. Let's go one by one in evaluating them. The first one, that global energy supply shock, that's what we know what that looks like. It's a 2022 redux, so to speak. You have a war that escalates and it disrupts either parts of energy transport or even energy production. Listeners will know what I'm speaking about. The Middle East is the candidate for this. And it's always has been. We've been worried since October 7th, really just about the Israel has bilateral conflict spiraling out of control and eventually drawing in Iran, the US and other regional actors. And that regional war could lead to the closure of shipping lines, which would already be enough. I think 1/5 of global oil shipping goes through the Straits of Hormuz. So even there, you would have to at least attach a risk premium, if not revalue energy prices up. That would obviously feed into inflation. We already see the kind of the recovery in energy prices from roughly $75 to $90 a barrel per oil, already making itself felt in monthly CPI prints. So that effect would be much more magnified, and that would be a profound risk to kind of the base case. The second scenario is much more abstract, because in the second scenario, actually nothing happens. Nothing material happens. But it's the one that actually, from a probability standpoint, we're even more worried about, because risk metrics have just been so favorable. The risk premium have been low and compressed across the globe. If you look at financial markets, actually, by the time of this recording in middle of April, some gaps have closed. But until the end of March, we were at ultra low levels in volatility. And I'm not talking only equities, but particularly in commodity oil volatility at very low levels. We were seeing spreads on sovereigns and corporates, even in among emerging markets that are a bit more questionable, highly compressed, very tight, really hard to justify with a world that's fragmenting and falling apart. And so wherever we've looked, the only thing you saw was gold prices slightly elevated. That was the only indicator that there are some worries in pockets of the market about risk. So risk is low, underpriced, and that is the starting point. So our worry is simply markets are underpricing. It's just a normalization of those risk premia. That is basically what we're worried about. And what would trigger that? What would trigger it is simply you get some event risk where markets say, oh, actually, maybe this, we are a little bit more concerned about that. For example, I'll just throw out a few random examples. North Korea, South Korea. North Korea allows, you know, not only launches missiles, but one lands on South Korean territory, breaks a 25-year precedent. Something like that, with nothing happens, nobody gets killed, no severe damage, but just breaking the precedent would force markets to reevaluate the risks that we're looking at. Or China stages an exercise in the Taiwan Straits that leads to a very short-term closure of the straits, maybe even just a day or two or a couple of days. But that simply alone would be a signal of, like, are we really pricing the odds of things appropriately? And if you think about it, back to the base case, if you think what's been market drivers, the large tech caps, the AI-powered rally, those two would be affected by a reevaluation of those supply risks. NVIDIA receives almost half of its inputs from Northeast Asia. So any type of risk premium repricing would have a magnified effect across all asset classes. And the problem here is that when you move from a low risk regime to even a normal one, it doesn't happen gradually. It's not like you go from like 10 to 11 to 12, 13. No, you have a fairly sudden repricing. And that repricing in itself has cascading effects, as it forces large institutional investors to rebalance and therefore has knock-on effects. So basically, we're just worried about markets waking up and saying, hey, risk's underpriced. Let's reprice it higher at it suddenly. And then, of course, finally is the U.S. election. But maybe we leave that for later.
I was just going to say, before we come to the U.S. election, why do you think that risk is so underpriced currently? And if you could just elaborate on that.
That's a tough question. We have, as part of State Street, the custody bank has visibility on a very large share of global institutional holdings and flows. So we have insights into positioning. And from that positioning, we can tell that some of it is the fact that investors are relatively cautiously positioned to begin with. Even if you think about the overweight in US tech, to some degree, if you think about the world fragmenting, again, the US is a little bit more insulated than anywhere else. Technology is a little bit less input intensive. It sits on large cash pile, has strong positive earnings. So in some ways, it's not even such a risk asset per se. It has a little bit of a hedge built into it. But investors have high cash levels still. They are underweight, classic risk assets, you know, emerging markets, some of the other beta economies around. And so that is one explanation. The other explanations are a little bit more contentious around what's driving some of it. One could argue that the monetary policy settings globally actually have not been as tight as perceived, because there's been repeated liquidity injections for last year in the US because of the regional banking crisis. There's been episodes in China. And so as a result, you basically have actually a little bit easier financial conditions than previously thought. And that would obviously also price risk premium lower. But there's no great answer, what I would like to communicate here.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks for going through some of those factors that could be contributing that. I would like to talk about the US election. Where do you see the risk there? What would be the implications for markets?
Yeah, so there we have basically three vantage points. Well, the first is, most importantly, and it ties into the first two risks very, very intimately, is that presence of the election itself is a risk factor for global geopolitics because it's an incentive for actors across the globe to entertain more adventurous policies because those could impact on the election. So if you are a small, mid-sized, or even large actor on the geopolitical scene, in 2024, you have the opportunity to basically intervene in the US election, either by doing things that favor the incumbent or weaken the incumbent from your perspective. That alone means the odds of something happening are higher, and that is something to take into account. And frankly, if you look at recent events in the Middle East, some of it is thought through the prism of how does it relate back to the US and US election dynamics. I can certainly tell you that the US administration is clearly framing policy very much with the November election in mind. So that's the first most acute thing. More things are likely to come to a boil simply because there's an election. The other thing to drive is to what degree the election tilts domestic policy. There it's a little bit less. We've been of the belief that if data really is on the verge, we think the Fed will be tilting slightly dovish because of the election in the background of their minds. They don't want to be responsible for an economic downturn. They may be slightly worried about the inflation agenda presented by the challenger, and they may also be a bit concerned about their institutional independence too. So we think if data really is on the border, we think it'll tilt dovish. But the big one is more ex-US. And then, of course, that's just the run-up to the election. Then you have financial market pricing of the outcome. Frankly, we look at a myriad of indicators in trying to forecast election outcomes. We did very well in 2020. And I say that only because our current dashboard model, so to speak, is very close to 50-50. So it's going to be very tight. And so that alone means, that's the second point, you will have some uncertainty premium that gradually sneaks into markets, markets that are sensitive to regulation, to the fiscal monetary mix of the US, and to some degree also to the US foreign policy stance. That uncertainty premium from our historical studies starts in the second quarter. Right about now, it starts to sneak in and it melts away, meaning markets catch up with it as you get closer to the election and markets gain confidence around the outcome or in terms of forecasting probability. And then, of course, really the big thing is, well, what's the impact of the outcome? What policies will change? And as a result, what assets will have to be repriced, given that they'll have either a regulatory, a fiscal, a foreign policy dimension that affects their valuation. And so frankly, let's talk about this a little bit more, because I think there too, I think actually markets are misunderstanding what's at stake this time.
That makes sense. So a lot of moving parts here, but you touched on as the big themes, a potential energy supply shock, risk premium repricing, and US election. So what are investors doing as a result of all these challenges?
As I said, they're not doing that much. We've seen some hedging on gold, but by and large, that's a little bit. We've seen some just recently, now in April, we've seen some catch up in volatility metrics in some risk premium, but it's just kind of the beginning of what we think will be a longer road. On the US election, we see nothing so far in terms of investors placing bets accordingly. And it's also a little bit early for that. Traditionally, US elections are best expressed through US equity sectors, kind of, you know, which sector benefits from a change in government policy and regulation. We think in the past, dispersion between kind of the top sector and the worst sector was quite large around the election, particularly in 2016 and 2020. We actually think that dispersion will be smaller this year. It actually won't be as great as in the past. But that type of investor behavior, we only start to see in the second half of the year when kind of the real bets on the outcome are placed.
And to follow up on that, what do you think is different this time than in 2016 when it comes to that divergence or dispersion between the top and worst sectors in US equities?
I think what's different is the right question. And what's different is the backdrop. So if you remember, there was a big market rally when Trump and the Republicans won in 2016, unified government around a very clear policy agenda that involved tax cuts and deregulation. Markets loved it, and markets were right because tax cuts came, and you basically had a real strong rally, a multi-year rally on the back of that. The difference in 2016 and 2024 is that in 2016, the US had the highest corporate tax rate in all of the OECD. It now is right around the average or slightly below. There's not as much fat to cut. And so the goodie bag will have to be smaller by definition. So that's one big difference. But the other two differences are even more stark. The second one is that the fiscal deficit was running at close to 3% of GDP. The primary balance was just slightly negative in 2016. It's a completely different world today. We have a deficit in excess of 6% of GDP. The primary balance itself alone is above 2. These are very, very expansionary fiscal stance during an economic recovery. Actually, it's unprecedented to run these types of deficits during an economy that's actually doing quite well. And so how much deficit expansion can you really tolerate if that's your starting point? I would argue quite very little. And the third one is, what were the financing costs for the deficit? In 2016, I do remind listeners, go back, the US 10-year was at 1.8% in the week of the US election. Where's the US 10-year now? It's north of 4.5. And so what you could get, if we had the same election outcome in 2024, you would get the return of the famous bond vigilantes. You would get a little bit of a bond revolt. And that is obviously not great for risk assets, for equities as well. And so we think that's one thing that has not been, it's gradually sinking into the discourse, but I don't think it's fully appreciated yet, that the potential for a positive fiscal impetus is just much, much weaker in this time election round.
Great. Well, thanks so much for going through all of those factors. You said at the start of the podcast that review is sanguine, but walking through all of these potential outcomes, it sounds actually quite unclear, quite uncertain. I don't know if you have any any final remarks before we wrap up?
Yeah, the final remark is simply that insurance has been cheap, i.e. to hedge against bad outcomes has rarely been this cost effective. It's particularly cost effective because, you know, typically when you're buying options, you have to roll them over. It's very expensive. You have certain time contracts that you have to observe. And so therefore it can feel like it's a drag on your portfolio. But this time we know that risks will ebb by year end. So it's an easier way to kind of frame your most acute risks, hedge accordingly. And again, we're sanguine about the base case, but we do feel like one has to have a little bit of protection.
Makes sense. Well, thanks so much, Elliot. It's been a pleasure. Thanks as well to our listeners. Be sure to subscribe to OMFIF Podcast wherever podcasts are available. And be sure to check out our coverage of public investors' asset allocation decisions in our upcoming report, Global Public Investor, which will launch June 4th. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the OMFIF Podcast. If you found today's conversation engaging, make sure to stay tuned for additional thought-provoking discussions on worldwide finance, economics, and policy by subscribing to our channel. Stay connected of the latest developments by following us on our LinkedIn page, OMFIF Economic and Monetary Policy Institute.